thank you for tuning into this episode of the Hunt, Fish, Eat podcast. Tonight, I sit down with my buddy Brandon Hayden. So Brandon was a chef at a small farm-to-table restaurant up in Smithville, Missouri. He brings a ton of information and knowledge to how to cook and specifically how to cook wild game. So sit down and listen. We're going to talk about a couple different methods and some tips and tricks so that you too can be successful when you're cooking the things that you harvest. Welcome to the Hunt, Fish, Eat podcast. I'm here with my buddy Brandon Hayden. Is that right?
Sure enough. That's how you say it.
I didn't know if you're going by a different name now. all right, we probably shouldn't talk about that. Okay. Well, Brandon likes to cook stuff and eat stuff. I also like to cook stuff and eat stuff, so that's why we're here together today. So Brandon and I met,
it was the opening weekend of dove season this year.
That's right. That's right. I think about 6-8 weeks ago, my wife was joining the Wilderness Ladies at a mentored dove hunt, and Brandon and I got roped into mentoring, and and then Brandon cooked some awesome food afterwards. What'd you cook that day, Brandon?
So that day we made polenta just with like some herbs and cheese and cream, you know, just over an open fire. And took the dove breasts. We used one of Hank Shaw's recipes from his Hunter-Gather-Gardener book, I think. That's the book I'm talking about. And pound them out flat and put some crust on them, fry them up, serve it with a tomato gravy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. Too many people put doves in. They just wrap them in jalapenos and throw some bacon in. There's nothing wrong with that, but you can cook a real meal with the stuff that you shoot. You don't have to just make snacks out of bits and pieces. I mean, everything tastes good with jalapenos. So.
You know, it's like you can take a Vienna sausage, wrap it in a jalapeno, put cream cheese there and bacon and grill it, and it's going to be really good.
I don't even know if it would taste too much different than the dove.
No, I don't think so. And that's we'll get into this a little bit later, but I always hate when people kind of shoehorn wild game into like a corner, you know, about what's good or not. But so, Brandon, we'll kind of go back here for a moment. So, you don't cook for a living currently?
Not anymore.
Okay, so what do you do for a living?
Right now, I fix air conditioners, commercial refrigeration, walk-in coolers, that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Okay, and so what got you into that game?
I used to cook. I cooked for a living at a place called Justice Drugstore up in Smithville.
Okay.
And it was all farm-to-table, you know, really local stuff. We only cooked with things that you could buy within like a 100-mile radius. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was it's Missouri food. You cook with ingredients that are grown here. And I really liked it. I enjoyed it. I had a ton of fun. But I saw all my friends going to school and taking vacations and talking about retirement funds and paid days off. And when you cook for a living, that's not really something that
happens. No. You work all the time on your feet and it's go, go, go.
Yeah. It was Thanksgiving. My friends all had the week off for school and I worked every day except Thanksgiving. I had no holiday pay.
Yep.
And that's not any dig against the place I worked at. That's just kind of the industry standard. That's what that's what it is. And if you're going to live that kind of life, that's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't do that anymore. So I was going to go back to school, but a guy that I had worked for before said, why don't you try a trade? And if you still hate it in a year, then go to school. But try a trade first. So I started changing filters and just kind of learned it all. And now I go from restaurant to restaurant. And instead of cooking, I fix their stuff when it breaks so they can keep cooking.
And you go there from 8 to 5. And
that's exactly right. Yeah, my favorite thing to do is to say, have a good weekend as I walk out at 5 o'clock on a Friday.
Yeah.
Makes me happy inside.
No, that's the truth. And I don't know if you knew this. I've worked in restaurants before for about 4 or 5 years and it's a grind, man. And, you know, I've shout out to people that can work in restaurants their whole life. Like I've done it. I did it to make money, but it's tough, man. It's tough to do that grind all the time. It's grind, but that's awesome. So you did cook a little bit, like I said, the Justice restaurant up there, and you got some cool tips on cooking. When we cooked those dove breasts, you whipped out a knife and a honing rod and started going to town. And I was like, okay, this dude's cooked a little bit. It's pretty evident. And I can't attest, the doves that we made that day, that was phenomenal. That was phenomenal. And it was the most gourmet meal I've ever seen made on a park bench at Glen Elder State Park. So you got that going for you. I think it was Yumi and was it Colton had like a little system going on. And we even made some for someone that was gluten intolerant.
Right. You know? What we did there is one of the women really wanted to eat dove heart. I guess she'd had them before. I'd never had them before that day.
I hadn't either, yeah.
But it was really good. We just skewered them and a little salt and pepper and put them over the flames and cooked them up. And like the texture of them was, man, almost kind of like a chicken nugget, not too cheap. Yeah. Like I don't.
Yeah.
I'm going to gripe later about how people want to relate things to food that they're familiar with, but that's what, you know, that's what we do. People say everything tastes like chicken.
Yep.
Just wasn't a chewy texture. It wasn't, there was nothing off-putting about the texture and just salt and pepper on freshly grilled meat. How can you complain? No. I had to, from making jalapeno poppers just before that, I'd still had some jalapeno seeds on my hands. So after I ate it, I was walking around for 10 or 15 minutes trying to figure out how these dove hearts are so naturally spicy. It turns out it was a jalapeno, but
hot tip there.
Really for a second.
Hot tip there. Make sure you clean your hands. I was crazy to me too. You know, she was like, hey, put salt and pepper on there and just skewered them and roasted them over fire. And I've had some good food like that when I'm really, really hungry and tired and cold and it was good, but I really wasn't hungry, tired or cold. And it was still really good. I was impressed, and I've eaten heart before from, you know, deer and some other animals, and this was different, and it was delicious. I mean, like, I will never throw a dove heart away again. I mean, it was super quick and simple.
No, the next week I was sitting around my house trying to think of how I could make a salad or, like, something to use a couple of dove hearts with, because, you know, you're not just going to serve 15 dove hearts up, and it just would be a little weird, but I was trying to think, like, could we maybe do a play on, like, a French steak frites but make it into a salad, maybe with some fried potatoes or acidulated potatoes and you know, salsa verde or something like that. But it just got me thinking all week of all the things that you could have done with those little dove hearts, and they were so easy to cook, but just the flavor speaks for itself on those little guys.
Yep. No, that's absolutely right. And if you kind of hear some chewing and finger licking in the background, we're eating some ossobuco and some awesome polenta. So we'll talk about this more later too, but one thing I love to do is take some offcuts or stuff that people leave in the field or traditionally leave in the field and make some really, really good food with it. So, I made some ossobuco this afternoon and some polenta with wild game stock, and, I thought it was awesome. I don't know what you thought about, Brandon.
It was fantastic. I had to ask him, you know, what are we eating here? Cause I mean, people talk about how wild game is gamey, is like there's something wrong with it, or it has to be tough, or it has to be dry, or it can't have any flavor, or it needs some kind of overpowering sauce for you to want to enjoy it. And there's nothing like that going on here. That's just some braised venison shanks, and it was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's crazy to me that you guys will just cut that lower part of the leg off and leave it, or your processor don't use it either a lot of time, but I process all my own stuff, so I get to keep it. And it's phenomenal. And, you know, my family, they aren't big wild game eaters, or they weren't before I started cooking a lot. And they've eaten this, and it's kind of the same thing. It's like, this isn't like a crutch or like a, I don't have to explain the dish. It's just really good, you know, and tastes good. So it's kind of one of my, like, favorite go-tos. And it's not too complicated to make. So, but hey, so how long have you been hunting, Brandon?
So when I was a kid, the short answer is something like, I don't know, 7 years.
Okay.
I didn't grow up hunting. I think I went deer hunting once before I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
My friends all did, but I never got into it. But as I was a senior, I went to a different school. I moved back to Cass Midway, where I graduated from. And I'm watching a volleyball game, and some of my friends, you know, they're all leaving. And I said, where are you guys going? And they said, oh, we're going to go hunt doves. And I'm like, well, I want to go hunt doves. So we ran to the gas station, got some tags, and that's the first hunting I did was as a senior in high school at my buddy's farm. That's kind of when I started. And mostly ducks, that kind of stuff. I never got into deer hunting. I shouldn't say never. Like, I have not yet gotten into deer hunting. Just maybe haven't had the opportunity to appreciate it yet or to really, you know, no one has shown me, one has taught me. So that, I mean, and it's just like anything else. I don't know if I'd be as big into bird hunting now if I didn't have buddies that started out dove hunting. Yep. And then when it got colder, they said, okay, we're going duck hunting. And I kind of tagged along. And once you kind of get introduced, you can teach yourself some more. But like when you don't know how to size a pair of waders, it's kind of hard to get into it.
No. And, you know, it's, like I said, I'm an adult onset hunter as well. It's my parents didn't hunt. I didn't have like an uncle to take me, you know, and I've had a lot of great mentors over the years, but it's really daunting and intimidating to people that have never hunted to start hunting. And, you know, those of us that have hunted for a while or people that grew up hunting, it's hard to see that, you know, from the other side. You know, it's kind of like clay shooting. I shoot a lot of clays, and, you know, if a buddy calls me and says, hey, let's go shoot targets, I know that means I need to take probably 100 rounds of 12 gauge, my shotgun, my eyes, my ears. It's going to be this much for a cart, going to be this much for targets, you know. It's going to take about an hour and a half, 2 hours, you know. He didn't know any of that, you yeah. know. And it's kind of the same thing with hunting, man. You know, it's there can be a barrier to entry on the knowledge level. But I think we're going to go turkey hunting this spring, right?
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. I, like I said, that's another thing. I did it once in high school. I had some buddies that said we're going to go turkey hunting. And man, if there was a video of us doing what we called turkey hunting, it would be something that like you watch so that you could laugh at something. Like we're walking through the woods making random noises with our mouths because one guy told us that that's what turkeys sound like. Like we're just in regular t-shirts and jeans, just walking over hills, like almost like jump shooting ponds for duck. Yep, like that's what we thought we were going to do with some turkey. And,
you didn't see any turkeys, did you?
That didn't work out for us.
Didn't work out. That's interesting. That's interesting. So, no, and I, you know, when I first started hunting, so I was 16, and a buddy of mine both wanted to hunt, and we didn't have anybody take us, so we got our hunter's ed, and I went out into the field. I think I probably had like 100 rounds of ammunition with me. I was ready to kill my limit of squirrels, rabbits, and upland birds, man, and we didn't see anything, you know? And so I can relate to that for sure. And but I, one of my favorite passions, one of the things I love to hunt is turkeys and in the spring. And it's just early in the morning hearing them gobble. And I explained to people, I said, you feel the woods come alive and you feel them gobble, you know, and it's just like a different, for me, it's a surreal experience. You know, it's, it almost, like, I don't want to do anything else. You know, if you had to hunt deer during the spring, I don't think I'd hunt deer as much. I mean, I just love the turkey hunt. So I'm excited to take you. I don't think it's going to be a really good time. So that's going to be cool. Well, we kind of talked about what we ate a little bit, about you hunting and who you are. So let's talk about, let's get into cooking. So we kind of talked about this earlier, but I kind of want to set the stage. So the reason I brought you on and wanted to talk to you is you do have some how do I phrase this, professional cooking experience.
Just a little bit. Yeah. I like to remember it that way. I think some of the people I worked with might have, you know, maybe this guy's like a tourist here. But but I like to think of myself as having some professional experience in in cooking. And it does transition to... It's kind of like the same situation as we talked about with being an adult onset hunter. Mm-hmm. If you kind of get someone to show you the ropes, if you have an idea of what you're doing, you can grow from there. If you have somebody that says, okay, here's how you hunt ducks. You need at least 2 dozen decoys, a pair of waders, something to keep you warm. You need a shotgun. You need to put a plug in.
Yep.
You can't shoot lead. Like, you know, teach you the basics. You can kind of grow from there. And it's kind of the same. I feel like with food, my wife, you know, she doesn't cook very much. I cook at home, but it's just so much easier because I have that base knowledge and just a couple of years of experience doing it. And now, you know, I have a bunch of cookbooks at home and you can expand on that. It gives you something to start with and you can take that and apply it to whatever you might be trying to cook or wanting to do, whether that be baking or searing steaks or turning doves into something delicious on a bench in a state park.
You know, and that's exactly right. And that's kind of one reason I wanted to bring you on. I want to kind of try to make this approachable for people. You know, one thing I try to do with this podcast is not to talk too high, you know, up on technical stuff, but provide information and get people started. And I know a lot of people say, well, I can't cook. And it's like, man, if you can start out just doing a couple recipes and kind of understand how those recipes are, why it tastes the way it tastes when you do certain things, you can grow so much, you know, and you can go, oh man, well, I did that with steak. I could probably do it with this cut of meat too, or whatever. And especially as hunters, you know, we're harvesting the game ourselves. We're out there. A lot of us, I butcher all my own stuff and, you know, you cut up birds, I'm sure. And so it's, you know, you got to kind of learn some stuff. And I think we should be good cooks as hunters, or at least have a couple good dishes up our sleeves just to cook what we're killing. So, and we talked about earlier, one of my biggest pet peeves is when people say, oh, deer's always dry, or deer's real gamey, or, duck tastes livery or something like that. And it's, they don't have to taste that way. So
No, not at all. Not at all. Mm-hmm. people get to these things, and if you were to go and grab a steak from, you know, let's say you go to the butcher shop down the street, you know, the best one in town or something, and you say, give me that tomahawk ribeye steak, and you know, you've got this beautiful cut of meat, and then you sit it in the back of the car, and you just leave it there in the back seat. You go inside to the next door, and you pick up some cheese, and you set that in the back seat, and it's 85 degrees out today. Then you go get a bottle of wine, and you leave that bottle of wine in the back seat, and then you go play around a golf. And then you come home, and you set that stuff out on the counter, and you think you're going to start cooking with it now. And then you take that big tomahawk steak, and you don't season it whatsoever, which I might not be opposed to if it's a good cut of meat. But you don't do anything to it at all, or all you do is salt and pepper, and you throw it on a grill, and you cook it to well done. Mm-hmm. Do you think that cut of meat's going to taste good, or at least as good as it could?
No, not
a chance. And it's the same thing. You know, if you shoot a deer, and you know, you let it sit for 30 minutes while you're sitting in the stand, and I get that. You don't want it to get up and run again. Yeah. But then you spend 30 minutes getting a good picture, and then you spend 30 minutes sending that picture to all your friends and calling them and telling them about it, and then you walk back to camp, and you get the four-wheeler, and then you come pull that deer out of the woods, and then you let it hang while you drink a couple of beers and take some more pictures. Well, I mean, by this time, that deer's been dead for 5 or 6 hours. It's the afternoon. If it's opening weekend, there's a reasonable chance it's 50, 60, 70 degrees by the time you're even starting to cut into that deer.
Yep.
And then you set it in the back of the truck because you didn't bring any ice, and you drive it home. How much have you degraded that meat already? And you don't even have it cut into steaks yet.
Yep.
So when you start to cook something, and it's kind of like respecting what you've killed, what you've taken. And I don't mean to be preachy or anything by that means, but if you're gonna kill a wild animal and you want to do something with it, you're not just trophy hunting, you want to cook with it, why don't you give yourself an opportunity to make it taste good? That's where it starts at. When people say that, you know, deer is dry or it tastes gamey, well, did you get that meat cooled? Because when they cut that ribeye, they cut it in a walk-in cooler.
Yeah.
From the before that cow was dead, it was in a walk-in cooler. Mm-hmm. Kept at temperature. There was good sanitation practices. Mm-hmm. It was stored right. It didn't, you know, the proper amount of air was allowed to move over it. It wasn't just kept outside, or, you know, it was aged. Mm-hmm. People thought about and had a plan for how they were going to prepare that meat before they killed the cow. The system was already in place.
Yeah.
So maybe if you apply that and just start with a good, you know, it's not obscene to keep one of those instant ice packs in your pack when you're hunting pheasant. Mm-hmm. If it's a warm day out and you shoot a bird, the bird's warm, it's in the back of your bag, it's getting sunny, you're going to keep walking. Break up one of those packs of ice, the instant ones, and just throw it in there on top of the pheasant.
You know, and if it's hot, you're going to be hot, and you're going to like having the little ice pack, you know, on your back. And you're absolutely right. You know, what I tell people is you got to plan for success. And what I mean by that is if I'm going out in the deer woods, I have a knife with me guaranteed, and not just, you know, to cut stuff, but like it's that's to gut the animal.
Uh-huh.
So especially from the home of the bow, because I may have to wait 2 or 3 hours to go track the animal. So it may be sitting there for 2 or 3 hours or expired, you know, and ran for an hour. So I want to make sure I can gut it as quickly as possible. And then I'm thinking about, okay, I have this vehicle with me. I can go put it, you know, this is where I'm going to get ice, which is, you know, 20 minutes away. So I got to think about that, you know. And a lot of people don't do that, you know, just like we talked about. So,
we go down to the state park every year. We go down to Roaring River and we catch trout. And you can always tell. We always have a cabin full of guys. And I keep Ziploc bags in my fishing vest. Because as soon as I'm done, we're going to go over to the cleaning station, clean it, gut it. You know, if we're going to fillet it, if we're going to leave it whole, whatever we're doing. They're in a Ziploc bag before I leave. And as soon as we get back, they're either going in the fridge or the freezer. And some guys, they'll just leave it on the stringer and bring it back and throw the stringer in the fridge, and it just sits there, and you kind of limit what your opportunity to do with that animal is because you didn't take the time up front to properly preserve it. You know, mine, if I've cleaned it and it looks nice, I can serve that thing whole with the eyes and everything in a big, beautiful dish. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you've kind of let the animal expire a little bit, you know, I'm sure you can fry it up just like anything, but you limit yourself mm-hmm. if you don't take those proper steps, just like you were talking about. Bring a knife, bring a Ziploc bag, bring yep. something so you can process it. Because if we're comparing wild game to the game that you, to the, you know, the beef, pork, chicken that you get at the grocery store, before that animal was even born,
yep.
there was a plan in mind for how they're going to process that meat. So give yourself a chance and plan on how you're going to process that meat. And that's a good first step, I think.
No, that's absolutely good. And I kind of wanted to talk about that at the beginning, just because if we don't have that down, it's really hard to do anything else well. You know, there's not a magic recipe that's going to make something taste good if it rotted in the field or was gut shot and hung out for a long time. And it's kind of the same thing with waterfowl or really any birds. A lot of times they're gut shot. Most of them are. And, you know, I snow goose hunt a lot. And, you know, you throw the, you know, the geese on top of the blind, or the same thing with ducks. And it's, you know, if they're out there for 2 or 3 hours, not that big of a deal. But you think about it, if they're out there all day, 8 hours, and you throw them back in your truck, drive home, the other 10, 12 hours, they've been dead. And yeah, that goose isn't going to taste good if it's gut shot and sits there forever.
And we're guilty of it. How many times do you hunt all day and, you know, you get your limit, or maybe you don't quite. And so you sit outside whole time, the sun's up and those geese have been sitting out, or those ducks have been sitting out. You throw them in the truck, get home. You get home, it's 8:30, it's dark, you want a beer. Are you cleaning those birds tonight? Let's be honest, because I know sometimes I don't clean those birds tonight. Yep. But that limits what you're going to be able to do with that animal on down the road. Maybe, you know, it doesn't limit it, but it definitely limits what you can execute well.
Yeah.
Can you serve that whole duck breast, you know, or the whole roasted duck, and does it taste as good as if you'd, you know, or maybe now do you have to... You have to serve that as, you know, cut it into strips and make it some kind of popper, or or deep fry it, or make it a schnitzel.
Like, yep.
You have to kind of mask what you're doing, because you didn't start with a good plan for how you're going to process it.
You're absolutely right. So that kind of covers a lot of that stuff. And, you know, I've been eating wild game for a while. I've been cooking wild game for a while. And I have yet to have a piece that I've treated well and cooked, you know, reasonably well, not come out good. You know, where it comes out, oh man, this is inedible or anything. And so I think if you can treat the game well to start with, it's going to get you miles down the road. So so wild game, I kind of asked this question, is wild game gamey?
I think, and these opinions aren't, like, they're my own, they're what I believe, but this is passed on from other articles and stuff I've read, but and I feel the same. Gamey, we use, I think, as a term to say that we don't know or we don't understand what we're tasting. It's definitely, if you shoot a squirrel in the woods here in Missouri, it's going to taste different than a piece of chicken. Like, it's lived an entirely different life than a pen-raised chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It's eaten acorns and nuts and what have you out in the woods and I mean, maybe it ate some things that you wish it didn't eat over the course of its life.
Yeah.
Whereas that chicken has been raised to, I don't want to say boring, but I mean, like, there's thousands of cookbooks dedicated to telling you how to make a piece of chicken breast taste good, because it doesn't taste good. There's no flavor at all. It's a blank canvas. Whatever you season it with is absolutely what it's going to taste like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not quite the same as trying to cook a piece of game. So I think we use gamey. You'll hear people sit down, and even if you've done it well, sometimes the first thing you'll hear them say is, this doesn't taste gamey at all. And I think that just kind of means that, like, it's not unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
We use it to say we're not sure what this tastes like, or maybe this is a little strange. It's not quite what we're used to.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think most people are kind of used to being spoon-fed, very simple, easy to understand, like, and I kind of, from my time at the drugstore, food is art to me. On the high end, it's art. And so if you go, you know, you take a kindergartner from art class and you go to the Nelson Atkins, are they going to understand what they're eating? And that's not to say that wild game can't be simple, but it's a little bit more complex than a chicken breast from Price Chopper. So if you just say, oh, it tastes gamey, because what you mean to say is, I've never had anything that tastes like this before, then sure, it tastes gamey. But that depends kind of on how you define gamey, and I wish people wouldn't say that word. Like, think just a little bit harder for a second and a half about what you're really tasting. Same way as if you went to the art museum and you see people standing there staring at that art for 5 minutes before they even comment on it. Take a second to think about what you're tasting. Maybe like if you eat a diver duck, does this taste different than a mallard that's eaten corn its whole life? Yeah. And define those flavors. Think about them before you just say, oh, it all tastes gamey. Mm-hmm. Or, oh, all duck is greasy or yep. oily. Well, if it's, you know, if you just leave that big piece of fat sitting there and you didn't get all the fat to melt and to cook down before you served it up and get a crispy breast on it, then yeah, it's going to taste greasy or oily. And part of that is because people are used to cooking easy foods to cook. I'm going to keep going back to chicken breasts, but if you're used to cooking a plain piece of chicken breast and everybody's mom's made chicken for them growing up and everybody's mom overcooked chicken for them growing up. Mm-hmm. So if you're used to eating just a plain piece of tough chicken, or even if the chicken's good, it's still just chicken. And so, you know, compare that to an animal that's had a very different life than a chicken. Don't just say it tastes gamey. It's not gamey. Mm-hmm. Take a second and think about what you're tasting, and you'll find that you might have a better appreciation for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one example I use where I tell people is, I'll even show them. So I took two wild pigs last December in Texas, and one was about 275-pound sow, one was about 100-pound boar. And, you know, if you look at pork, like if you go to the store and pick a pork chop, it's kind of white. You know, it's pretty... it's not red, not pink, you know, it's kind of it's a little pink, but it's pretty light. If you look at that wild pig, it is red. I mean, it's almost looks like venison, when I pull it out. And, part of that is because that pig had a different life.
Pork is not white meat. People don't know that. They don't realize that. The pork farmers, whoever that is, many, many years ago, wanted people to think that pork was white meat. So they bred their pigs and intentionally tried to make the pork that you get at the store look like chicken because people wanted to eat more white meat. Mm-hmm. So they said, pork is white meat. It's the new white meat. It's not white meat.
Yep.
They've bred them to be that way. A domesticated pig is drastically different than a wild boar because they bred the flavor out of it is what they did.
Yep.
They dumbed it down so that you could do anything to it and you didn't have to think about flavor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did to pork.
So. Absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, they've leaned them out too. You know, domestic pigs are very lean generally. You know, there's some heritage breeds and some small farmers are doing some great stuff with chickens, pigs and things. But in general, you know, if you go to Price Chopper or Walmart, what you're getting is that very lean piece of meat. So no flavor and it's hard to cook. And, you know, that pig that I took in, that sow that I took in Texas, I mean, the pork chop was probably 3 inches taller than the loin was, and half that was fat, you know, and it was beautiful, wonderful, delicious fat. And, you know, I trimmed a lot of fat off that hog, and I'll use it to cut with any wild game that I want to grind up or anything, and it's delicious. And, you know, but that's an example too. What I do is whenever I kill a pig, I take a little bit of the fat off and just fry it in a pan and eat it. And if it has an off flavor or something, I don't use that fat. I can still use the meat, but because the pig eats anything. You know, and generally you'll be good, but that's just kind of a, you know, something you got to know about wild pigs. But, so we talked about that. So let's dive in here. Overarching concepts. We talked about a couple of them. When you're approaching wild game, what, if you could give someone like two or three things to think about that would get them down the road and when they're about to start cooking wild game, if this person already knows how to cook, what would those couple things be?
The first thing I would say is, and I would say this if you're going to cook anything, is salt and pepper. Don't forget to flavor your food. If you're going to season something, general rule of thumb is going to be 1% salt and 0.5% pepper. So, you know, you can eyeball that. Really, you can. Just think about how much a reasonable amount of salt is, and you probably know it. But if you want to get technical with it, if you're going to cook a piece of meat that weighs a pound, you should get your scale out and figure out what 1% salt is and 0.5% pepper is. And that's a pretty good base start. So if you cook something and it doesn't taste good and you say, man, I'd rather have just had a hamburger at McDonald's. Well, I'll tell you what's in that hamburger at McDonald's, and it's a bunch of salt. Yep. So don't forget to season your food. Start with some seasoning. The basic amount of salt makes everything taste better. Clogs your arteries, but it makes it taste better.
Hey, we're about food tasting good. I didn't say about artery clogging. You know, from a physical standpoint, so to get flavor and things to, you know, when you taste things with your tongue, it's a chemical reaction. And, you know, there's electricity and stuff going on. And my dad's a chemist, so this is above my head. But salt helps make that reaction happen on your tongue so you can taste things more. You know, and the way I relate it to people is if you're eating something and it kind of tastes flat, you know, like a soup, and you're like, man, there's just not much body to this, and you put salt in it, it changes. It increases those other flavors. It makes sweet things sweeter. You know, you can taste it better.
It's the same reason if you make sugar cookies, you'll see that there's a teaspoon or a tablespoon of salt in that recipe. And you're like, man, what the heck's the salt for? It's because you can eat a cup of sugar and you're not going to taste that sugar unless it has some context. You need something around it to help the flavors come out. And that's what salt does. It's opposite of that. It's going to help that sugar to come through. It's the same thing with all your other meats. You're exactly right with the soup. Mm-hmm. You need salt in your food to make it taste the way that you think it's going to. Yeah. And if you get stuff from the store, we're going to keep talking about how things come from the store. People don't realize a lot of that stuff is brined. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, you open a bag of chicken up, and even if it's not in brine when it comes to you, it was definitely brined before it was packaged. They're going to make a big thing of water and put some salt in it and probably some preservatives and maybe a little, you know, herbs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And if you go to a restaurant and you're going to order a fried chicken dish, I can almost guarantee that they brine that chicken.
Yep.
No fried chicken place worth their salt's going to serve It's going to serve chicken that hasn't been brined. And the same with your pork. All these meats, if you go to a nice restaurant and you sit down, they've done something to it to impart salt and flavor into the inside of the meat, not just sprinkled a little bit on the outside and threw it on the grill. So, you know, that's another thing as far as putting some flavor into your food, especially just basic salt. You don't have to get crazy with your brine, but, you know, like a buttermilk brine for catfish or something. Put some flavor into it. Make a big pot of water and put some salt into it. Warm it up and dissolve it. And then put your meat in it. Let it sit there for a couple hours overnight. Cook it the next day after you've let it get some salt into the inside of it. Throw some herbs in there. Warm it up and let it do its thing. Give it a chance to taste good.
Yep.
Give it the same respect and like forethought that the people that sold you the chicken at the store did.
Yep.
You know, put some flavor in it.
You're absolutely right, Brandon. And so we've talked about salting. You know, like I said, you need to season your game, and salt and pepper are so critical, especially salt. So what's the next kind of concept you would give or tip you give in general about cooking, or especially cooking wild game?
Don't overcook it. Don't overcook it.
Yeah.
You know, like I was talking about with that, with the big cowboy ribeye with the big pork on it. You're not going to throw that thing on the grill and cook it like a roast. Mm-hmm. You're not going to put it in the oven and cook it to 350 degrees all the way through. You're going to get some grill marks, cut that baby open, and just let the meat taste like meat. If you take a backstrap and you throw it on the grill and you just cook it until it's a piece of charcoal, it's not going to taste good. It's going to taste dry. It's tastes dry because it is dry.
Yeah.
And that's not the deer's fault.
Nope.
There's not as much fat in most wild game. It's leaner. You don't need to cook it as long as you think you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So don't overcook it. Ease up a little bit. You know, read a couple of books. You don't even have to read a book. Just whatever you're going to cook, Google a recipe real quick. Google a couple of recipes and see how long it takes to cook that thing. People have done it before. It's not impossible information for you to gather.
Yeah.
You can bust your phone out and Google, you know, how long should I cook this catfish fillet for?
Mm-hmm.
And someone's going to be on there saying, this is how long you need to cook it for. This is the internal temperature that makes it safe to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get to those, you know, that safety point, you should probably stop. <That's
it. laughs> Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, so I kind of want to make a comment about that. One thing that I did when I first, I've cooked my entire life. My dad loves to cook. I love to cook, and just something I've always done. And when I started hunting, I just adapted recipes that I've cooked other stuff with. You know, beef recipes go really good for deer. You know, same thing, chicken for pheasant. You know, duck is closer to deer, really. You know, it's a red meat.
Uh-huh.
And what it's not super difficult. You know, I mean, it's really, if you can find a chicken fajita recipe, just use pheasant for that. You know, and I don't want to like interchange chicken and pheasant. They do taste different, but it's like, man, that's a real easy way to start. You know, this doesn't have to be super complicated. And kind of like you said, man, one thing I tell people overarching for wild games is leaner. And you may cut a deer open that's, you know, a little later in the season. You know, she's been eating a ton of corn, and there's layers of fat on her. Well, with a deer, you know, that fat, it kind of has a waxy mouthfeel. So you don't really want to eat any of that fat from a deer or much of it. And there's no intermuscular
right.
fat.
It's not going to be marbled the same way that a cow exactly. is. I mean, the cow is it stands still. It doesn't do anything. The muscles aren't flexed nearly as much as that whitetail. I mean, the whitetail's constantly moving its head, looking for predators, looking for this or that, or eating. Whereas, I mean, not to call cows lazy, but they do just walk around and keep their head to the ground and eat grass all day.
Yeah.
And they're genetically, just how they're built is different. The fat in a cow is going to be a good cow. You know, something that's been raised well is going to be marbled. It's all through it. You see it when you get a thing of ribs.
Yep.
There's not just fat on the outside. I mean, there's going to be that fat cap, but all through the ribs, there's going to be fat in there. And all through your different, you know, big cuts, your primal cuts are going to be marbled with fat, whereas your antelope is not going to look the same way when you look at how the fat content is, where it's located at and how much of it there is. It's just not the same, so you don't need to cook it the same. It's a different animal.
You're absolutely right. And you know, without that extra fat in there, there's not a lot of extra moisture and not a lot of extra flavor or from that fat. You know, a lot of people don't understand that fat carries a lot of flavor.
Really is the flavor. If you were to take pork and beef and maybe not chicken, the texture might be, but if you took five red meats, you lined them all up and you ground them down and then you took all the fat out of them and you set five ground meats in front of me and none of them had any fat left in them anywhere. You cooked it without the fat. There's no fat. It's going to be really hard to tell those animals apart because the fat is the flavor.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the flavor is at.
Yep. So you need to, when you think about that, when you're cooking a piece of wild game, if you aren't going to use the fat or it doesn't have fat, that's definitely a consideration you got to make. You know, and so like that ossobuco I made, it's made very tough cuts of meat, you know, that have the bone in them, not very much fat. And so it's like you got to cook it for a long time with some wild game stock, with some carrots, onions, and celery, you know, spices, herbs, you know, and it's like, oh, now there's a lot of flavor there. You know, it's just, you just have to think about how you're going to get that flavor in there or what flavor you want to put in there, you know.
We made some duck enchiladas a couple of nights ago. And we just seared the duck. This super easy recipe that you could knock out at home and, you know, go to the grocery store, put the stuff on the list. You can do it on a weeknight. It's not that big a deal. We'll just sear the duck breast and we put it in my Instant Pot, put some enchilada sauce in there and drain the duck fat into that thing. You got some cooking liquid. You put the duck in there. Ran it for like an hour and 15 minutes and it just pulled apart with a fork. While that thing was cooking, we got some masa out. We made some handmade tortillas. And you just roll them all up with some cheese, put some more cheese over it, throw it in the oven, and it comes out. It's fantastic. There's nothing wrong with it. You're not tasting that and going, oh, it's gamey or it's dry. It doesn't have to be if you think about how you're going to cook it.
Yeah.
You know, use the tools that you have around you. One of the other things that I like to do with wild game is take advantage of sous vide cooking.
Oh, yes.
You can get a sous vide machine for like $100 on Amazon, which is cheaper than a grill. It's cheaper than a lot of other, you know, a KitchenAid mixer. That's not an exorbitant amount of money for a kitchen appliance. And it does more than anything else in my kitchen as far as making sure that the food tastes good at the end. So take your cut of steak for your deer steak.
Let's hold on just a second. So let's explain what sous vide cooking is.
Gotcha. So sous vide is French for under vacuum. What you're going to do in sous vide, you put your meat and your flavor and all the stuff you want to cook it with in a little vacuum seal bag. You can get a vacuum sealer and you can do that. Another effective way to do it is grab a Ziploc baggie, put all that stuff in there, fill your sink up with water. As you push that Ziploc baggie underwater, the water is going to push all of the air right out of it. You get to the top, zip it sealed at the very last second, and you'll be set. Not perfect, but it'll be good enough that you'll be able to cook most things. So you're not using anything else to cook it with. You're just using warm water to warm the meat and cook it through at lower temperatures for longer periods of time. And you can really control the flavor. You're not going to burn anything.
Yep.
It's great for hitting a temperature, and then you can throw it in the fridge. And when you want to cook a couple of deer steaks, you just cut them open and pull that piece of meat out. It's going to be cooked perfectly medium rare the whole way through, and all you got to do is put some grill marks on it.
Yep.
don't have, it's not complicated as far as like when you're working a kitchen, you call it the pickup. What do you do to fire this dish when you're going to make a plate? You've already done all the prep work. Everything's all ready. The mashed potatoes are already mashed. What's the pickup? Well, that's, you know, put a little cream and butter and warming it up in a skillet. The pickup on something that's been sous vide is you're just going to cut the bag open or open your Ziploc baggie and pull that delicious already cooked piece of steak out, throw it on the grill, put some grill marks on it. You don't have to worry. As long as it's warm in the middle, it's done. It's all cooked.
Yep. You know, and that you're absolutely right. And what I love about the sous vide is I can set it to like 125 degrees, which is, you know, rare, or 130 degrees. You know, and like I said, it's going to be that temperature through the entire piece of meat. You know, when you put something in an oven or when you put it on a grill, pan, whatever, you cannot cook the entire piece of meat at the same temperature. You know, you're cooking the outside, and so you're hoping that temperature to go, you know, in through so it's safety, right? The cool thing about sous vide, and you know this, Brandon, is it's that same temperature all the way through. So you're not overcooking it or undercooking it. You know, and like you said, man, it's that, for me, it's a huge time saver. You know, I'm doing a wild game dinner this Saturday night, and I'm doing some goose legs confit. I'm doing some backstrap that's going to be like a prime rib sandwich kind of thing, and it's going to be cold. I'm doing a couple other things, but I'm doing a lot of the sous vide before time, you know, beforehand, and then that day or about an hour before we serve, I'm going to sear some of this stuff, and it's going to be awesome.
Uh-huh.
You know, so that's a good tip, man, the sous vide. I love that. So
you can kind of control your fat, too, a little better. Yep. You can trap it in there. You know, if you put just a little pat of butter, just a half a tablespoon in with your whatever you're cooking, it doesn't matter whether it be duck or deer or pig or anything. You can throw a little extra fat in there if maybe your cut is pretty lean, and you can kind of impart some extra flavor and you know, buttery goodness on your meat. You know, it's not going to roll off the grill or you know, burn up in the oven. It's going to be in the meat. And it'll definitely cook with it. It helps to, you know, to bring some flavor to it. And your restaurants that you go to are using this technique.
Yep.
This is the same thing. You know, why can I not get my game at home to taste like, you know, the duck dish does at Michael Smith's or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the techniques that they're using, that's what's going to give you the flavor and help with the execution. So if you think about those things when you're cooking the meat, you know, what would you do to cook a delicious piece of fried chicken? You would brine it, you would sous vide it, and then you would fry it at the last second. Mm-hmm. So it's not tough on the outside before it gets cooked all the way through. And if we use that same approach with our wild game, we'll get better flavor out of it. And to me, that's almost like, I'll go back to the respect issue, respecting that animal. You know, you did kill something so that you could eat. And let's take the time to do it right and give that, you know, what it deserves, rather than just, throw it on the grill and wrap it in bacon.
Yeah. You know, and we talked about before we started recording, you know, there's some guys that, you know, grab the back straps and the antlers and walk out, man. And, you know, and I don't want to, I'm not saying that we need to, you know, take the silver skin out and make bowstrings and, you know, wash out the intestines. I'm not saying that, but I think you've taken a life, you know, taken an animal's life. And I think the responsibility that comes along with that is you want to use as much of that as you can. And like I said, I'm not saying you got to build your house out of the bones and stuff.
No, not at all. But there's more cuts of meat that are actually delicious on animals than people think about. You know, I know a duck wing is really small, and it's some work to get it. But part of the thing that I think makes the food taste better to me is I put in work to get that food.
Yep.
I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, or I didn't even sleep last night so I could go be at the duck blind so I could get a spot. I could get drawn so that I could hunt this duck. And how many hours did I put in this summer shooting clays so that I might shoot a few more ducks this morning or make a better shot on that deer sitting in the stand. And, we put all that time into it. Crap. I forgot where I was going.
And then we don't, I think what we're trying to get to is like, you put all that time into those things and then when you cook that thing and you get to eat it, I mean, it's like all those memories and it all pays off.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, that's what I was talking about. All the work that you're going to put into to hunting it, put that work into – you don't do it every time, but just once. Just once. Grab a cube of wax and a bucket of water and pluck that whole duck.
Oh, yes.
Pluck the whole duck. Roast it all up. Or once you pluck it, pull the legs off and cook those confit and pull the wings off of a couple of them and save them up. And then when you got the people over for the game on Sunday, throw a couple of duck wings in the fryer too. Put like a, you know, an Asian soy sauce or something like that on them, mm-hmm. and serve them up just as something cool. Tell people, you know, I shot these ducks and this is something cool. I think you'll like. You know, give it a try.
Yeah.
We used to cook at the drugstore. I'm going to keep going back to the drugstore because it's the bulk of my memory. Mm-hmm. But we used to do a dish. I want to say it was stripers, and we took it was like the gill area. It wasn't the gills, but it was
the cheek kind of
like
thing.
Like bass cheeks. Mm-hmm. And we took them and, you know, they're almost like, there's not a ton of meat there, mm-hmm. but you could take them and grill those up and they'll grill up in just a second. It takes almost nothing extra to pull those cheeks off of that bass. You know, if mm-hmm. you go out and you catch a couple of bass and you take them home, you're going to fry them up, cut those cheeks off, throw some olive oil on them, put them on the grill. And there's just some extra flaky, it's great meat. Mm-hmm. It's great meat.
Yep.
You can do more with the animals that you pull out than you think you can.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it every time. There's nothing. I breast out plenty of ducks.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while, try the whole animal.
Yeah.
I mean, you killed the whole animal.
Yep.
So let's eat the whole animal.
Yeah. You know, it's to me, it's almost a crime. Like when you see guys shooting turkeys and they just breast it out. You know, and I'm like, man, there's meat on the back. There's meat on the thighs. There's meat on the legs. And like, I know a lot of that meat on the legs is hard because there's a lot of tendons running through it. But it's like, man, what I do is I pluck as much as I can and then pull the breasts off. And what I did this year is I plucked the entire thing and then boned out most of the meat, kept the thighs and legs and throughs in a vacuum pack, threw them in the freezer. And then I trimmed all the rest of the meat off and I took the carcass after I gutted it and roasted it and made some stock out of it. And that's some of the wild game stock that went into our polenta tonight. And it's like, that's
man,
a lot of work.
That was good. That was really good.
Yeah. Man, that's kind of a clutch move on that. But, you know, it's like, I'm not doing that every day. And to me, it's like, man, it's a really good end product, you know, and you don't have to do it all that day. You know, if you can kind of cut it up and then over time, you know, if you have a afternoon where you have a little bit extra time, you know, do some sous vide stuff, do some confit things like, you know, confit some legs or, you know, you don't have to do it every day, but it's really, really good.
Take one of your duck breasts, you know, you shot six ducks today, you got a limit, so you got a dozen duck breasts. So take 11 of them and freeze them and cook them as duck breasts, but take one of them and put it in curing salt and make some prosciutto out of it.
Like,
the recipes are out there. It's not super complicated. Mm-hmm. If you want to do other things with your animals, there are guides, there are resources you can use, and you will appreciate it. You will enjoy it. You'll look back at that and you'll think that was really fun. It kind of like adds another element to the whole outdoor experience. To be able to do something special, and your wife will appreciate it.
That's right, man. You know, what I tell guys is when I'm hunting ducks and I see that mallard set his wings and drop his feet, my mouth starts watering, man. You know, I'm just tasting that duck breast, you know, with that nice duck fat on it, man. And it starts to come kind of full circle when you're hunting. It's, you can't wait to harvest that animal. You know, it's not just about the grip and grin. And, you know, like in Kansas, you get one buck and five doe tags, man. I'm excited about taking, you know, two or three does. Because that's a lot of meat that I can play around with and have some awesome food, you know? So let's talk about a couple things. Can you, like, what is one or two of your favorite recipes with wild game? Now we've talked around them and talked about a couple of specific ones, but if you give me like one or two just basic recipes that you would go with.
So my first and favorite recipe, my favorite thing to do is the duck breast. You know, I grew up, that was the first thing I learned to hunt. So it's the first thing I learned to cook.
Yeah.
So you take your duck breast and take all the feathers off, make sure there's no little white feathers left on the back anywhere, and then score that. So you're going to take a really sharp knife, like a fillet knife, and just cut crosses in. You'll make little X's, little diamonds all over the fat on that duck breast, and you put it in a skillet. You want the skillet to start out cool, start out on low heat. So that starts to cook all of the duck fat out before it starts to cook the duck. That way you can get that crispy skin, get all of the fat out so it doesn't taste chewy. And your end product will, the whole bite will be delicious. You won't pick up a bite and have to spit out the little fatty part. So start with a cool pan and start to get that fat out. I normally will serve that with like some Brussels sprouts or carrots and fried potatoes. I always peel the potatoes and cube them. I think that makes them the best. A lot of people want to slice their potatoes like thick potato chips, but you put it into a pan. There's no way that you can get the optimal amount of crispiness on those potatoes if they're all laid out like that. One's going to be sitting on top of another. Yeah. You'll have one piece that's burnt and one piece that's not cooked yet. And then we make a little sauce while we're cooking it. I always use some kind of vinegar, like a red wine vinegar is great. Take whatever jam or jelly you might have in your fridge. If it's something local and obscure, you know, if you've got a lingonberry jam or even, you know, blueberry jam, strawberry, something sweet and fruity, and take that and mix it in with your vinegar and put a little extra sugar in there. And I just serve the Brussels sprouts, the carrots, some kind of hearty vegetable next to my other starch of potatoes and put that duck breast. Once it's done, after the fat's all cooked out, you're going to turn it over, set it at the edge of the skillet where there's the rounded part at the edge of your skillet that normally perfectly matches how rounded a duck breast is. So you can kind of get a good full color all the way around that, and then take it and just slice it, you know, short ways across all the way down the duck breast, get some nice bite-sized pieces, lay it out, and then put your sauce over the duck. I think that's great, and you can normally make it with the stuff you have in your fridge. So it's great for after a long, cold day, getting snowy, getting water in your waders, or throwing your gun in the marsh, you know, that kind of stuff. You get home, something you can normally make without making an extra trip to the store, but it definitely just brings out the flavor of that duck, and it's good to have around the fireplace or around the dining room table at the end of the day. And my wife likes it too, so it works out.
Yeah, my wife loves duck. You know, I do something similar to that. And, you know, one thing I use is if I don't feel like making a sauce, I just use chunky applesauce. Man, you know, I got a little three-year-old, so there's always applesauce in the house. And, you know, if you cut that duck breast across the grain and just a little bit of applesauce on top of that, man, it's like it is out of this world, you know, with that duck fat and everything. And one of my favorite things with duck is to cook it medium rare or rare. Man, I hate it when people overcook duck. You know, or cook anything really, but it should be red in the center. You
know? Absolutely. It should. I mean, if you pull it off and you think, well, me personally, if I pull it off and I think it's not quite cooked enough, it's definitely not quite cooked enough.
Yeah.
But if, you know, a normal person, if you're thinking like, you know, a piece of pork that you might want it to be medium, maybe medium well, or a piece of steak that you're looking for a medium. Mm-hmm. If your duck looks like that medium and you think, oh, I should let it go a little longer, stop.
Yep.
Pull it off. Set it on a sheet pan, like a little cooling rack. You know, you take cookies off and you put it on the cooling tray. Just set it on there and let it rest. Just let it hang out for a few minutes before you cut into it. That way it'll hold the juices in. It'll carry over cook to what you think it by the time you cut it, after you let it rest for a little bit, it's going to be perfect.
Yeah.
So if it's completely done how you want it in the pan, by the time you set it out and let it rest, it'll carry over cook to too far well done.
Yep.
And it'll start to be chewy. So let it rest.
Yep. And I want to pull a couple things out of what you just said. And these are things that I've learned over time that are real critical. Any piece of meat you cook, any whole piece, after you cook it, you want to let it rest. You know, especially if you're searing something.
Uh-huh.
You know, let it sit for 10, 12 minutes just on the counter, and then cut into it. And if you've never done that, I'm sure people have seen where you cut into something and all these juices run out. So if you let it rest for 10 or 15 minutes, it just doesn't do that as much. Don't lose as much juice. And it's a lot more moist, you know, inside Absolutely. That piece of meat. And then, I was going to say something else I cannot remember, but we'll move on and come back to that. That's if you can let it rest, that's so critical. So that's your first favorite recipe is duck.
Yep. First favorite recipe would be duck. My second favorite recipe, man, I'm a sucker for fish. I really like that trout, whole trout.
Mm-hmm.
Just take your fish and throw some butter in the middle of it. Sprinkle plenty of salt and pepper on it. And put some fresh herbs inside the belly of that fish. Mm-hmm. Put your oven at 350. Wrap that thing in tin foil and set it in the oven. You can cook it around a campfire even. Just plenty of butter and some fresh herbs, salt and pepper. And cook that fish. 350, it'd take like 10 minutes or so.
Yep.
By the time you're done, the whole thing will just peel right down the bones. You can make some tacos out of it. You grab some tortillas, a little cabbage, cilantro and lime. You can do fish tacos. You can do anything with that fish once it's whole. You can serve it whole with with kale or potatoes or whatever you want. But a whole fish, I think, is super easy to execute. And if your dinner partners don't mind looking at the eyes, and I think it looks beautiful, but yeah, some people are a little off put by it occasionally. But it's something that you can do that's really easy, but it's really good, and it looks really good too. You can put it on a plate. You can say, look what I did. And people are like, holy cow, I can't believe I'm not paying $100 for dinner tonight. Because you don't see that anywhere other than that. And it's something you can do that just like, it kind of sets a tone. It says like, wow, that's really nice. How did he do that? He didn't do anything. You just put some butter and salt.
You did less effort. Right. Yeah, you didn't have that at all. You know, and yeah, I remember I was going to say earlier, and it applies to fish too, is you talked about the duck breast and with fish, if you cook it to doneness in a pan or over a fire, it will be overdone on the plate, you know. And the example I use for this is if you ever cook scrambled eggs and you cook them in the pan and then put them on a plate and there's moisture coming out of the scrambled eggs, they're overcooked. And so just like with eggs, if they're cooked in the pan, they'll be overcooked on the plate. Same thing with meat and fish. If it's cooked in the pan, it'll be overcooked on the plate, you know. So you want to get it really close, let it rest. It's going to carry over that 5-10 degrees.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to be awesome. You know, it's not going to be overcooked. It'll be nice and moist. So,
and the difference in that 10 degrees is all the difference.
Yep.
I mean, no one wants to eat something that's rare. Like, that's definitely off-putting. Mm-hmm. Because so the risk there, you think, is if I serve something that's underdone, no one's going to like it. And if I serve something that's overdone, they're not going to like it, but they're not going to complain. Like, no one's going to not eat dinner tonight because it's overcooked. But the good thing about that is you can take it off and let it rest and make your plates. And then if you look at it and you're like, man, it's still not done, you can put it back on and you can cook it longer, but you can't uncook it if you overcook it.
That's right. That's right. No, and that's a good tip. You know, if you're playing around with this or trying to learn how to do it, you know, err on the side of undercooked. And like you said, man, and I use an instant read thermometer a lot, especially when you're newer to this, just because it's very hard to tell what the internal temperature of meat is when you haven't done it a bunch.
Your little hand trick only works after you've cooked 1,000 steaks. Yeah. Then you can use the hand trick. And I'll tell you, the whole time I worked at the drugstore, there was no hand tricks. Everybody in the kitchen had an instant read thermometer. Mm-hmm. If you're cooking burgers, even out on the patio kitchen, you're using a thermometer to find out what the temperature is.
Yep.
You need to know for sure what the temperature of that meat is so that you know when to pull it off. You know, don't cut it open and then see, oh, what is it? Well, you just ruined it. There's nothing you can do to fix it now without using an instant read thermometer. That's a great tool for you to use when you're going to cook, especially bigger pieces of meat, to know what that internal temperature is. Mm-hmm. Is it just a piece of flesh still, or am I close? Do I need to pull it off?
Yep.
That's a great tool.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they used to be really expensive. You know, I have one that I think was from St. Arthur or one of the flour companies. And it, I mean, when I got it, it was about $100, but you know, they've come down quite a bit in price and there's some good ones out there. You look at restaurant supply stores and Walton's Inc. makes one that's, I guess, like $15 or something. And it's reliable. It's useful. You know, and I mean, I use it all the time when I'm cooking because I want to know if that steak's at 125 degrees or 130 degrees, you know, and that's the quickest way to tell, you know, be sure fire every time. So consistency. So we've talked a couple of your favorite recipes, Brandon. What is your favorite thing to hunt?
My favorite thing to hunt, well, the thing that I'm looking most forward to hunting this year is actually some new things. I've been hunting duck for a while now, and I just, you know, last year got involved at the Pheasants Forever chapter in Johnson County, and I think I've shot 3 pheasant in my life.
Okay.
I just got a bird dog.
Yeah.
So I went out to Pennsylvania, Eagle Rock Setters, and I really liked Mike. I thought he was a great guy. So we made the pilgrimage out there and got an English setter. He's Truman. He's 4 months old now. I'm hoping that we could maybe catch the tail end of pheasant season. Maybe he'll be ready. And I'm really looking forward to hunting some upland birds with my new dog this year. I haven't done a ton of it before, but it's highest on my list right now, more so than duck hunting. I probably won't do a ton of duck hunting this year because I'm really excited to get on some quail and some pheasant. And we're going to South Dakota later this
year.
Looking forward to that. I've been talking about it a lot recently.
Well, I'm excited for that. You know, that's a trip I take every year. And
It's friends and family, you know, and I'm glad you can make it this year. And I might rope you in a little bit of cooking.
I think I can handle that. I'll bring my knives.
That works. That works. So, well, I'm excited about that, man. You know, and like you said, I'm excited about this fall. And that trip to South Dakota is always one of my favorites. So I'm glad that you're going to make it along. So to kind of wrap up here or in conclusion, let's talk about a couple tips, or if we could boil down this whole podcast into kind of three tips for a new hunter that wants to learn how to cook some of his wild game. So I'll let you start.
Three tips. I think if you're going to take the whole thing, the whole last hour, and you put it into to three sentences, have something in mind for how you're going to clean your animal before you shoot it. You know, you spent the whole night before thinking about where you're going to set up. Do I need to set up on the east or the west? Or, you know, am I going to use an X in my decoy spread or a V or a circle? Like, you spend a ton of time thinking about how you're going to shoot the animal. Spend a little bit of time thinking about how you're going to clean it and be prepared to do that so you can process the animal. That puts you in a good place to be able to cook it. Number two, flavor it right. Put some seasoning on it. You don't have to kill it. Don't oversauce it. Don't go crazy. But put some flavor to it. Salt and pepper will go a long ways. And then the third most important thing is going to be don't overcook it. Like we just spent the last 15 minutes talking about. I can't tell you how important that is. If you overcook it, it's going to taste dry. It's not the animal's fault.
Yep.
It's your fault because you overcooked it. And people have this misconception that wild game is gamey and that it's dry. And it doesn't have to be. We just ate a delicious dinner and there was nothing gamey or dry about it.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it if you just put a little bit of forethought and common sense into how you're going to cook this animal. Buy a cookbook for it. There's plenty of resources out there. Hank Shaw makes some great ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you need to know to get started.
That's awesome, Brandon. And that's, like I said, I'm really glad you were able to come on tonight and let us chat about that. So, yeah. Well,
thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, man. I'm glad we could eat some food and talk about hunting, you know, in this fall and eating some talk about eating some more food. So, thing coming on. Any final thoughts or any shout outs you want to make?
Man, shout outs. I just really appreciate all the things the guys at Pheasants Forever have done for me this year. I mean, we wouldn't have met if it wouldn't have been for Wilderness. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, Jessica is a, you know, she works hard. There'd probably still be a Wilderness. But if I didn't know Pheasants Forever, I wouldn't know her. I wouldn't know you.
Mm-hmm.
I've made a ton of connections because of my involvement with the local Pheasants Forever chapter. And it's given me a ton of resources to, you know, expand the things I want to learn about, the things I want to know about. So just, you know, getting involved with them has made a huge difference in my appreciation and how excited I am about doing more bird hunting and other kinds of hunting in general.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my biggest shout out. Really appreciate them.
Man, and thanks for mentioning that. You know, I'm personally a member of Pheasants Forever and member of the JOCO chapter. And one thing I tell people is, you know, if you are an adult onset hunter and you don't have a mentor, you know, or someone to take you, go join like a local National Wild Turkey Federation chapter or a local Pheasants Forever chapter. And a lot of those guys, I mean, they're going to, you know, a PF chapter is going to be full. A lot of guys like to hunt pheasants. I mean, that's why they're part of that organization. But those guys usually hunt more than just pheasants. And, you know, if you show up and say, hey, man, you know, I don't know a lot about hunting, but I like the idea of it. And how can I help out? They'll plug you in.
They'll give you some work to do.
And tell them, hey, I want to learn how to hunt. And I guarantee you they'll help you out.
Yeah. You know? So people are willing to help. I think the biggest thing is, you know, when I started with Pheasants Forever, I really was concerned about what I could get out of it. You know, like how can I get some places to hunt? I want to do this. But since then, it's really grown into more like, how else can I help other people to kind of come after me, to follow me and to give them opportunities to be able to hunt pheasants? And you know, it's like we talked about earlier. It's not, you know, you can't just go grab a gun and start walking through a field. I mean, you can. Good luck to you. But that's a great thing to do is to get involved with one of those chapters. It doesn't have to be Pheasants Forever. I like Pheasants Forever. It's been great for me. But I mean, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers or Ducks Unlimited or the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, I guess, I assume. I mean, I'm not sure. But get involved with a local organization and it'll take you places. It will. It's been great.
That's a good point, Brandon. Well, hey, thank you for coming, sitting down with me and talking, and I'm looking forward to our adventures this fall.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did hanging out with Brandon and sitting down and chatting. Brandon's a really cool guy, and I'm going to have him on again, I think, so we can talk about more wild game cooking and all the awesome stuff that he can do, man. So if you enjoyed this episode, it'd really help me out if you shared it with your friends and family. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. When you do that, it helps this podcast come up in more searches and reach more people. Please go and like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it so you never miss an episode. If you want to help support the Hunt, Fish, Eat podcast and have an opportunity to do some awesome stuff with me, please go check out our Patreon page and feel free to jump on at the level of support you feel comfortable with. Our Patreon is patreon.com/huntfisheat. Our Facebook is Hunt, Fish, Eat Outdoors, and our Instagram is Hunt, Fish, Eat. Thank you, and catch you on the next episode.